This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Fast food's been around for a long time and is hitting a lot of milestones this year. 90 years ago today, or this year, the first hamburger chain, White Castle, started selling little square sliders for 5 cents. That same year, A&W Root Beer birthed the concept of franchising, offering its sassafras-flavored syrup for distribution. And 60 years ago, this year, the term fast food was first recognized by the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. North Carolina's role in the development of modern fast food culture is bigger than you might think. National chains that got their start in the Tar Heel State include Hardee's, Bojangles, and Krispy Kreme. And beloved local franchises like Cookout, Char Grill, and Snoopy's are regional success stories with hundreds of locations in North Carolina. So how did a southern state with a reputation for barbecue and slow home-cooked meals make such a big imprint on the fast food industry? We're going to get some help to find out the reasons for that from a pair of fast food experts. Joining me on the program is Andrew F. Smith. He is the author of a number of books, including The Encyclopedia of Junk Food and Fast Food, and his most recent work, the forthcoming book, Starving the South, How the North Won the Civil War. Andy, welcome to the State of Things. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here, Frank.
Also with us by phone is Blair Chansey. She's the editor of Quick Service Restaurant Magazine, a national trade publication based in Durham. Welcome, Blair.
Thank you for having me.
Andy, let's begin with a little fast food 101, at least when it comes to history. When did fast food become a signature ingredient of American culture?
Well, it really starts in colonial days. People have this thought that the fast food is really a 20th century invention, but if you look at all the accounts of Americans consuming food even in colonial days and certainly well before the 20th century, people consume food very fast. So in one sense, like 5 minutes or 10 minutes for a meal, in one sense it was time that mattered. So as America industrialized in the late 19th century, this was operationalized in a lot of different ways, like automats, for instance, came in, cafeterias were fast food operations. But what you said to begin with, what is normally identified as the first fast food chain is White Castle, and A&W Root Beer is the first franchise fast food operation.
I think few people know this, but the first Thanksgiving, they actually served turkey tenders. That's a little known fact.
That was another book I was going to write.
We turned that up in our research. Blair, White Castle of Wichita, Kansas, we're talking about that, generally credited with the first American fast food chain with their little hamburgers. Is there anything unique about the way fast food culture developed here in the South?
You know, specifically, the geography of the South really dictated what fast food looked like here versus in more urban areas. Especially now, within the 20th and the 21st centuries, you're seeing a prevalence of drive-throughs just because, you know, in places in the South, there's more affordable land. There's a lot more new development available. You're not looking at finding, you know, very small footprint places like you are in urban areas in the Northeast. So you are seeing some really kind of hip, new, cool designs coming into play in fast food in the South. Certainly also there's a flavor difference. People in the South like sweet tea. They probably don't have to tell your listeners that. But, you know, things like biscuits or really bold flavors are going to be very popular in the South. And actually, we're seeing that spread throughout the country because a chain as big as McDonald's just recently introduced a Southern chicken sandwich, which is something that's very familiar to people in the South if you've ever been to a place like a Chick-fil-A.
Something else that's very popular down here, donuts. In the headlines today, Krispy Kreme reported its first profitable year since 2004. Maybe you can remind us about how that chain got started, Blair?
The story about Krispy Kreme is really an interesting one. I mean, I think most people in North Carolina are very familiar that it came out of Winston-Salem in 1937. It kind of was this homegrown success story. Everyone loved the donuts hot off the line, and it was kind of something that was born, bred, cultivated, and loved here in North Carolina. They decided about 10 years ago to really do a big growth push. They went into new markets, both international and domestic, and they also went public. And with that move, the company really unfortunately suffered. So we saw them as a great regional story, but then kind of stumble a bit. Unfortunately, they became a very good case study for others within the industry of what not to do. And we saw them really not be able to regain their footing over the last 10 years, and companies like Dunkin' Donuts, which has about 6,000 stores in the U.S., even moved into Winston-Salem during that time. So we saw them kind of encroach on their home turf and become successful. But Krispy Kreme recently is expanding again, and like you said, they have seen same-store sales increase by 2%. So hopefully they're on the up and up again. We would love to see a North Carolina story do well.
Well, I guess since we're talking about breakfast, we should welcome Bernie Jennings to the program. He's the president and CEO of Biscuitville, which is now based in Greensboro. Bernie is also a member of the company's founding family. Welcome to the State of Things, Bernie.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure to have you here. Give us a little of the history of Biscuitville.
Sure. We started out really as a pizza restaurant chain, originally called Pizza To Go. Eventually changed the name to Pizzaville, and started selling the breakfast biscuit in the mornings. Obviously, for Pizzaville, we were a lunch and dinner business and thought it'd be a good idea to fill in that day part. The biscuits eventually outsold the pizza, so we changed the name from Pizzaville to Biscuitville, and that's what you see today.
And your father was a flour broker, is that right?
That is correct. He sold flour by the train carload, and that's not flowers as in roses, it's flowers as in bread flour, from the mills out in Kansas to the bakeries all over the Southeast.
Now, I'm guessing as a northerner, because you were doing those pizzas back in the 60s and 70s?
Yep, mainly the late 60s, early 70s.
See, now, as a guy from Buffalo, New York, if I'd had your pizza down then, I'm guessing you had something like a biscuit crust, and this old Buffalo boy wasn't going to like that too much.
No, it was still a traditional pizza crust. We did not use a biscuit crust.
But you're getting back to what's native to the area, and then you came up with a business model that kind of went against the grain, the idea that you were not going to stay open all day, which is the goal for most fast food restaurants.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we open up at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, and all of them close at 2 in the afternoon, which is very unusual in our industry.
QSR Magazine recently profiled you, Bernie, and the unique corporate culture of Biscuitville. And let me ask you, Blair, about that, about this corporate culture at Biscuitville.
I think, I'm sure Bernie can even put it more eloquently, but what was most interesting, what really stood out and why we profiled the company was the fact that there really is no ethics rule written down. I mean, a lot of these companies have gotten so large that they have these commandments that they live by or that they drill into their employees. What's really special at Biscuitville is they just simply use the golden rule. You know, you're doing unto others as you would want to have done unto you. And Bernie really exemplifies that and pushes that both on the corporate culture and at the store. Because remember, with fast food companies, you have two different levels of customers. So you have corporate people that you're working with, and then the customers are franchisees. And then you also have within the stores a culture that you have to push through from your employees to the people that are coming in to get served. So this is something that we've really watched pretty closely because it's quite unique as other companies have become very large and faceless and have had to bring in, experts to tell them what their culture is. Biscuitville has not had to do that.
How do you avoid that, Bernie? Because it's precisely the size that forces companies to be a little more impersonal with their employees. How do you avoid that?
You know, it really takes a lot. Well, it starts when you hire, at the hiring process, but it really is just a corporate culture, something we talk about in our training classes. And just to add on to what Blair was saying, one thing I try to talk about along with the golden rule is character. And character is what you do when no one else but God knows that you did that. So, it's, how do you, what actions do you take when no one else is going to find out? So we use the golden rule and that character example really to help teach our folks how to do the right thing.
Andy, is there something about the food here in North Carolina? We're talking so far about biscuits and about donuts. Is there something particularly southern or that allows these things to catch on? Because, a donut's a donut and a biscuit could be a biscuit. How do these catch on, and is there anything southern about them that makes them catch?
Well, Krispy Kreme is not a donut, is a donut. So I think there's a difference between yeast-raised donuts and cake donuts, which are typical of other donut chains. And so I think there is something very unique about that and about the way that donuts were developed in Krispy Kreme, and likewise biscuits. Biscuits are Southern. I mean, I can't wait now to get to North Carolina to give Biscuitville a try. I've got to sample the biscuits there. If they're made every 20 minutes, the biscuit places up here in New York, I'm sorry to say, it was probably made every 20 days. So there's a difference between the two.
And Bernie, there's kind of a quality control, I guess, to keep about the recipe. I mean, how do you maintain any kind of regularity and consistency store to store?
Oh, sure. We have a great training program, and we really have a competition once a year that focuses on the biscuits. So we have our crew and our management, two separate contests, compete to see who makes the best biscuits. But in that competition, we are watching everything they do, and it's a great reminder in the training process of how to make our biscuits and how we want it done.
Bernie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bernie Jennings, president and CEO of Biscuitville, on the State of Things, talking about fast food franchises that started in North Carolina with Blair Chansey, editor of Quick Service Restaurant Magazine, and Andrew F. Smith, the editor of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. Coming up, a drive-through history of Bojangles and clear the palate with a little bit of cheer wine on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Farm fresh ingredients and Southern style home cooked cuisine put North Carolina on the foodie map. But many fast food traditions also got their start in the Tar Heel State. We're taking a look at some of the well known and regional restaurant chains with ties to North Carolina. With me on the program is Blair Chansey, editor of Quick Service Restaurant Magazine, and Andrew F. Smith, author of the Encyclopedia of Junk Food and Fast Food. Andy, we just heard from Biscuitville. We talked to Bernie Jennings, a member of that company's founding family. How common is it to have somebody from the founding family of a fast food restaurant still leading the company today, a generation later?
That's most unusual. Most of the companies, of course, have gone public and are owned by larger organizations. And so I think it's fantastic to have companies that are still owned by families and that stay in the family for years. They can maintain quality and their name is on associated with their operation. So I think that's very important.
Is anything that, you know, keeping other companies from doing that? I guess it's just a question of how big you want to get. Is it just a matter of scale?
Well, I think it's also that usually people who start companies are not the ones that can take advantage of those and maximize their reach. So it's really how do you expand beyond North Carolina if that's what you want to do. And in most cases, the founding families have great difficulty in expanding their product to the United States or to the world. So I think that's one of the main problems.
Blair, let's talk about another North Carolina fast food chain, Hardee's. Tell us about the history of that company and how it's grown.
Oh, gosh, there's so much to say about Hardee's. Really, most people today will know about Hardee's because of their sister company on the West Coast, Carl's Jr. But actually, it was a chain that started here in North Carolina. And actually, in fact, one of its biggest franchisees is still based here in North Carolina, and it's based in Rocky Mount. And the Bodie Noel group has several restaurant brands within their portfolio, but they have about 350 Hardee's locations, which is pretty impressive. Hardee's, the size of that system is almost nearly 2,000 units, so it's about 1,900 stores. And really, you see that company divided by coast. So the Carl's Jr. coast is west, and you see that's where a lot of the scandalous ads come out of. And Hardee's a lot of times will run those as well. And we have seen some actual drama come up with our North Carolina franchisees and some of their hesitation in running some of those ads that we've seen most recently, the one for the new turkey burger. But that was something that started a while ago, and the corporation, Hardee's and Carl's Jr., have been pretty unapologetic about that, about saying that they are trying to attract young, hungry males, and, this is the kind of marketing that resonates with them, and that's what really makes them the brand that they are and sets them apart from a place like Biscuitville,
that
quite frankly.
Godless West Coast and their dancing star, Carl's Jr., which is the other thing. But you talked about the turkey burger ad. We should probably listen to that to get a sense of what you're talking about, although it is an eyeful as well. But let's listen.
To help you remember our delicious new char-broiled turkey burger, we hired Miss Turkey. To help you remember Miss Turkey, we put her in a bikini. And to help you remember Miss Turkey's bikini, we had it designed with little tiny pictures of our charbroiled turkey burger. And that's just the way it is. The new under 500 calorie charbroiled turkey burger from Hardee's.
So that's one of the things that can happen when a company goes national. Wait, was Hardee's started with a franchise in mind? Is that the idea?
You know, I don't think that many of the companies that we're talking about today have started with a franchise in mind. Most of them start with one very entrepreneurial family member, and Hardee's is something kind of similar. And then they see opportunity. And then that franchise model, as you talked about, started with A&W, and they begin to see that there are growth opportunities because the financing can't come solely from them. And so what we're seeing with a lot of them, especially when you talk about the children and whether the original families are still involved, usually second and third generations actually are interested in getting into sexier franchises. So while they may have something start with a very traditional brand like a Hardee's, the children will be interested in branching out into something else now that they know the industry, and will look for other brands. And they're especially seeing that as Gen Xers and millennials come into the quick service space.
Well, and nowhere can that be seen more clearly than Fredericks of Tarboro originally, and then they moved. But that was I bet you didn't know that either.
No, I didn't.
No, I just made that up. But the fact is that Hardee's is not the only big chain, national chain, to get started here. A regional chain, there is this one. Got a woman need to get a half a Bojangles. Bojangles' famous chicken and biscuits began in 1977 in Charlotte, North Carolina. Less than 10 years later, the restaurant had grown to over 200 locations. Today, 400 in more than 10 states. Joining me now is Eric Newman. He's the executive vice president of Bojangles, still based in the Queen City. Eric, welcome.
Thank you very much. Really happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about Bojangles' founding history.
Well, Bojangles, actually, we have a very sad event to report. This week, Jack Folk, the founder of Bojangles, passed away. His family still has a leadership role in the company. His daughter and son-in-law still operate our leading franchisee, which is Raleigh-based. And Tommy Haddock, who is his son-in-law, has a seat on our board of directors. So we still have a lot of Carolina's roots, a lot of strong North Carolina roots, and a lot of roots to our founder.
I'm sorry to hear that. Our condolences to the family. The founding of Bojangles, there's an interesting history. I mean, Bojangles essentially filled a niche. Tell us about how the spicy chicken came to North Carolina.
Well, I will tell you that that Jack personally developed the flavor profiles on all the products, all the original products, including the spicy chicken, and indeed developed a very very early following. But he told me the story that, and I remember this well as a customer, even before several years before I worked here, that the original Bojangles on West Boulevard here in Charlotte, which was just in a little old walk-up building, he developed the biscuit formulation, the made-from-scratch biscuits, and when he introduced them, there were cars wrapping around the block to get in, and sales went up more than 60% overnight. And as he used to say to me, we should have called it Bojangles Biscuits and Chicken, not Chicken and Biscuits. So chicken is at the core of things. Don't forget the iced tea. If you're a Southern iced tea lover, there's no place like Bojangles.
Where'd the name come from?
Well, at the time, this was, of course, in the mid-70s, and at the time, the song Bojangles was in full popularity, and there was it was reminiscent of you know, the food, the Cajun food of New Orleans, and of course Bojangles was the stage name of a man named Bill Robinson, and so it was kind of drawn from the times in which it emerged, as well as trying to invoke some of the food of the bayou.
Now, another Southern fried chicken that was born in New Orleans but didn't take its name from there was Popeyes. And there's a story, isn't there, how did Bojangles compete with those Southern fried chickens from Popeyes and Church's?
Well, the Bojangles is, of the three you mentioned, Bojangles is the youngest of the three. But again, the distinctives between, if you study what a Bojangles is, what a Church's is, what a Popeyes is, the distinctives are quite remarkable. And part of it is, again, in the nature of the biscuits, we do a breakfast all day. The biscuits are made from scratch every 20 minutes. And so there was a real emphasis on freshness, on flavor, on uniqueness. And if you look closely at the concepts, they're actually quite well differentiated. And we're the junior of the three in age, but we think we compare favorably.
Eric, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Eric Newman, Executive Vice President of Bojangles Famous Chicken and Biscuits. Blair, the fact is that Bojangles has just reached out and opened up a store in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, actually, that's where I'm based. And they've actually opened a store at Union Station. And I can say very anecdotally that everyone here in D.C. Is very excited. It's been, I think, on the local news. It's been all over Facebook and Twitter. The lines are incredible. They were doing promotions yesterday, giving out food. And I think we can confidently say that everyone in D.C. is already hooked.
And is there a certain sense of pride that North Carolinians take in their homegrown Bojangles?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you don't know what a bow round is, then, you know, North Carolinians, I think, when they're transplanted anywhere, are still very prideful of their state, and Bojangles is one of the great things that has come out of there, and I think it's really exciting because it creates such a cult following. The fact that it's not everywhere, you have to be, you know, south of Danville, Virginia to get one, really makes it special, and the fact that it's got a little bit of a kick and a connection to the Panthers, you know, What more do you want as a North Carolinian?
Well, Andy, tell us about the evolution of fast food, because one of the things about it that it did was homogenize the taste of America when we first sort of got onto it. Now are we looking for regional fast foods?
You know, I think we've...
I was going to put it to Andy, but I'm happy to hear from you as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go on.
I think that, you know, fast food has been, it all starts off as regional food and then it expands nationally. And White Castle really didn't expand nationally until relatively recently, in the last 20 years. So you have regional tastes and regional foods that are there that expand beyond that. But I think Americans have gone through a major shift in the last 30 years, and we like flavor. We like spice. And those are things that would not have been part of McDonald's restaurant, for instance, in the 1950s, or the other fast food establishments there, of which those were not prominent parts of their products. And today, of course, they're shifting and changing along with the Americans' taste and flavor. But the flavor of the South, the spicy food of Bojangles, for instance, and the flavor of Popeyes and the other restaurant chains that have done extremely well. Nationally, are there because of the people, Americans simply like that spice and like those flavors.
Well, one of the regional flavors that we enjoy here in North Carolina is a place called Andy's Burgers, Shakes, and Fries. And Kenny Moore joins us on the phone right now to tell us more about that company that he started in Goldsboro, North Carolina in 1991. Hello, Kenny.
Hey, good morning or afternoon, I guess, is where we're at.
We've just plunged into afternoon, like it or not. Andy started in one location in Goldsboro, has grown to more than 100, mostly in the eastern part of North Carolina. How did it evolve? Did you see it as a chain when you started it? Was that the hope?
Well, you know, I guess anybody in my position always wants to kind of dream big and think big. But I started in Goldsboro. I'd actually been fired from a job and had $500 to my name, and found a closed restaurant in Goldsboro, and kind of started from one. But and once we got the first one open, we really, really struggled out of the gate financially, the whole nine yards. And but I always knew we had a great concept, knew we had a great burger, knew we had good food, and just decided that I would expand it around the area a little bit, and now it's grown to over 100, and we're getting ready to expand outside of our borders.
Well, you know, our producer Amber Nimix tells us that Andy's is a huge hit with East Carolina University students. Why do Pirates love Andy's?
Well, I think it's because we've been there for so long. You know, it's been 20 years now, and one of our very early markets was the Greenville market, and I'm somewhat involved with the athletic program there too. My old college baseball teammates, the head baseball coach there, so we have a pretty big presence there at the stadium, and it's just been a wonderful, wonderful area. And believe it or not, we've had quite a few East Carolina people come to work with us after graduation and whatnot. So it's been a real good community for us.
And I understand you have some big news about the company's future.
Well, we are getting ready to expand beyond the borders of North Carolina. Recently did an interview on the John Boy and Billy show, and we've had 80 requests for franchises from Texas to Maryland and every state in between. So we are getting ready to ramp that up, and that's, matter of fact, I'm calling you today from Wilmington, North Carolina, in a meeting about that right now.
Going to change the name?
Possibly. Matter of fact, after having this meeting with my attorneys, we've run into a couple of issues on the name, so that's kind of still up in the air. But hopefully we'll have an announcement on that real soon.
All right, Kenny, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Kenny Moore is the founder of Andy's. Well, we've talked a lot about North Carolina fast food, so we need to wash it all down. This state is famous now for being the home of Pepsi. But guess what? Another soda is bubbling up as the official state beverage, Cheer Wine. Cheer Wine was recently featured in the New York Times Diner's Journal as the niche market soda with a cult following. Joining us now in the studio to tell us more about that is Tom Barbita. He is the vice president of marketing for Cheer Wine. Welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. It's great to be here.
All right. And what I love is in the New York Times, you know, it was, you may never have heard of it, but it's called Cheer Wine. And
like, that's right.
What do you mean you've never heard of Cheer Wine? but tell us about it. Tell us what Cheer Wine is for those of us who may never have heard
Well,
of it.
Cheer Wine is the nectar of the Tar Heel State. It is a brand that was birthed in Salisbury, North Carolina, 94 years ago. We believe we're the last soft drink company in America still run by the same family. We now actually have the fifth generation of the family involved in the business. And so it's not just an iconic brand, it's an iconic company, and it is starting to catch on in some really fascinating ways in different parts of the U.S. as people discover new flavors.
Nectar of the Tar Heel State. I dare you to put that on the billboard.
Yeah. Well, we're actually going to be putting some other things. We're actually got a new campaign that's going to be breaking very soon, and we're going to be calling Cheer Wine the legend, and we're going to be claiming what we believe the brand to be, and that is a 94-year-old legend, an iconic brand. Nothing like it in the soft drink category, so we're very excited about our plans.
Tell us about the history, how to get started.
Sure. As I said, got started in Salisbury by a gentleman named L.D. Peeler, and he was a merchant back in Salisbury back in 1917, and the brand was birthed around the same time that other soft drinks were created here in the United States. So soft drinks came out of the adult beverage. So ale became ginger ale. Beer became birch beer or root beer. And in our case, wine became cheer wine. So the color is a ruby burgundy color like wine. And the cheer is a little bit of the cherry flavor and also how it makes you feel when you drink it.
Cherry?
Cheery.
Cherry.
So it's a combination of the two, cherry and cheery and wine. And it's, you know, our bubbles are small. Our effervescence is unique. Our flavor is, you know, the brand probably wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for its unique flavor. And so we attribute that for our longevity.
How do you get the bubbles so small?
Well, that's part of the secret.
Trade secret. What do you think accounts for this, though, this whole cult following that the New York Times is reporting on?
Well, I think there is. Someone said earlier, I think there is a movement within the U.S. of people discovering and seeking new flavors. There's a popularity of foodies that are breaking out, you know, around our culture. And I think when brands like Cheer Wine are discovered and people realize there's this rich backstory, I think it starts to take people to a different place beyond refreshment alone. And so Cheer Wine has all of that. It has great refreshment, but also has a rich, rich history.
What do you think about that, Blair? Why is this catching on? What do you think?
Well, I think we also can't downplay, you know, the role of social media with creating cult followings in all of the brands that we've been talking about. I mean, I mentioned that people are tweeting about Bojangles, but they're also, you know, Facebooking about Cheer Wine and telling other people about that, about the brand. Where the news might have gotten out much slower before with, you know, people just kind of literally the old-fashioned way, word of mouth, people are getting this information much faster. So if they see a reference of something that they don't understand, what is Cheer Wine, a quick Google search can clear that up right away, and you can get right in touch with the information you're looking for.
And Andy, we haven't even talked about Cookout, another local chain that for a limited time featured Krispy Kreme and Cheer Wine cream-filled donuts.
Yes, I wanted to get down to North Carolina and give that a try.
it's good stuff.
I understand Cheer Wine also has ice cream out now. Is that correct?
There is an ice cream. There's a fudge. There's we might just bring back the Cheerwine Krispy Kreme donut. We heard it was very popular last year, so we're looking at perhaps launching that again this July. We'll just have to see.
Expand that beyond North Carolina. You got to make it up here to New York.
Thank all of you for being on the show today. Tom Barbita is Vice President of Marketing for Cheerwine. Thank you so much. Andrew F. Smith, author of a number of books, including the Encyclopedia of Junk Food and Fast Food, his most recent work, the forthcoming Starving the South, How the North Won the Civil War. You can find out more about him at andrewfsmith.com. And Blair Chansey is editor of Quick Service Restaurant Magazine, a national trade publication based in Durham. You can visit that publication online at QSRmagazine.com. Coming up, Hammer No More, The Fingers, live on The State of Things. Stay with us.